Football Weekly.
All aboard for another Football Weekly, a show that's so unmissable even Premier League referees can't fail to catch it. And today, in a show as well-rounded as Rob Stiles and almost as popular, we have Premier League. Hull put one across Wenger's bows, make him want to keel over, give fans sinking feeling. While at Wigan, there's hell to pay as world's richest club give poor performance. Analysis follows. There's the weekend's other news, a spotlight on Joe Effing Kinnear from one crazy gang to another, and the latest from the continent, more Bundesliga blues for Bayern, a controversial Barcelona derby, and Ronaldinho sinks his teeth into the Milan derby. There's posts, and we look forward to, and I mean really look forward to, the next round of the Champions League in Football Weekly today. Hello, listeners, and welcome on board to today's pod crew. Kevin McCarra, just back from Wigan.
Hi, James.
Hi, Kevin. And Raphael Honigstein. Where are you? Were you just back from anywhere?
No.
Just, you know, happy to be hearing that. And James Dart.
Hi, James.
Season debut for Darty.
Thank you very much.
Right. Excellent.
Everyone, no pressure at all.
No.
Good weekend did we have? Yes.
I was in the office, so it was highly enjoyable.
Right. With all the sunshine streaming down
exactly.
Outside, but you were able to enjoy Portsmouth Spurs in all its splendour.
In all of its, yes, not so much splendour, but...
Well, you'll be telling us more about that in a second. I was excited, Rafa, to read about Jens Lehmann in trouble for his commuting habits. You no doubt know about this. The 250-kilometre daily journey he's making in his helicopter to training at Stuttgart. Celeste Ferdinand used to do this. Everyone thought it was jolly flash, but in Germany they don't think it's quite so clever.
No, they don't like it because the place where he's landing, which is one of the richest communes in not only Germany but Europe, they don't tend to look favourably on people landing with helicopters in the middle of their little picturesque village. Yep. So he got into a lot of trouble. And
couldn't he just land somewhere else?
He could, but then what would be the point if you have a helicopter but I have to land, land somewhere else?
Can't he just land? He's landing at the training grounds, isn't he?
He's landing at the training under the local club.
Ah, okay.
Because that's the only open space. But that still sees him flying over the heads of all these millionaires
right. Around
the lake of Starnberg. And no, they say no.
Okay, the mayor says he's going to deal with this personally.
He doesn't have much on in Starnberg, you know. This is the sort of thing that makes the news and stays there for a couple of weeks.
Is he planning to shoot the helicopter out of the air?
We ought to mention the Premier League. And obviously, for once, we're going to give a bit of space to Arsenal because they lost 2-1 at home to Hull or West Brom,
yeah. As
Arsene Wenger thought afterwards. Although he was feeling physically sick at the time.
It's a bit odd, isn't it? Also, Gallas, I think, afterwards was quoted saying, we didn't know much about them, but they were quite good.
Mm.
You just wonder, you know, what? Obviously we know what's going on in the team talks, but perhaps not enough actual talk about the other team
indeed.
Too much of mumbo-jumbo, new age rubbish.
Indeed. You're talking about that memo that got circulated. Mm. Rather dull, wasn't it, the memo that got circulated?
Also, the David Brent comparison's been made immediately. There was that touch about it at the office, wasn't there? Getting back to the Arsenal game there, I mean, Hull, of course, fantastic. Played the forwards, tried to pass the ball when they could, scored two good goals in their own way. But the thing that amazes me most is to see if Wenger...
Sorry, Giovanni's goal good in its own way?
No. I'm thinking the second one was like a bad marking.
Oh, okay, right.
No, first goal's fabulous, sorry. Yeah. But the second goal was good from their point of view, but not from Arsenal's. In fact, coming to that,
right.
I see Arsene Wenger now talking about his centre-backs being a bit short. Blimey! This is so obvious that the podcast mentioned it last season. It's not as if Wenger doesn't know. I think he's always thought he can get away with this. But did you ever notice that France don't like Gallas at centre-half? Played him at full-back a lot. Chelsea wouldn't play him at centre-half. Do you see a theme here?
Oh, interesting point. Arsene also seemed to be hinting at a lack of commitment or indeed complacency among his players, which I think that was what, in his words, sickened him about the performance.
I think they were playing so well. I mean, yes, Hull deserved to win because of the obstacles they overcame and so on, but Arsenal, of course, played much better football over the whole course of the match, and probably they believed that goals were inevitable and that they would indeed walk them in large quantities as they would do in a Carling Cup tie. And I think once you're in that frame of mind and things start to go wrong, you find it hard to snap out of it.
Mm. Let's give a bit of credit here to Hull, though.
Oh, yeah.
They go up to
sixth
in the table. Well, A, because it's virtually impossible to go to the Emirates and win. Only one other team has done it in all Arsenal's league games there. And secondly, because they actually went behind. Yeah. They were 1-0 down. Giovanni then unleashed that screamer. And Cousin, as you say, getting the second. But a fantastic performance from Phil Brown. I don't want to damn them with faint praise, but are they going to be the new Bolton, do you think?
I think you've just damned them with faint praise, Jan.
praise?
I mean, early Bolton. Yeah.
Early Bolton. I think, I mean, the styles aren't quite so similar. I think Bolton for a far more direct, far more long ball approach with it as it's been. Phil Brown has been quite technically astute, I think, in these opening games. He's really come in and brought a lot of momentum with the promotion, and this can still happen. It's almost the bounce effect of coming through the playoff has given Hull this momentum that's carried them through these opening games. And but it's the form on the road, it has been quite phenomenal, and no one would have really predicted any of these results. If they can start adding a few more points at home, then they're going to be well on the road to a bit of safety at some stage. And as has already been mentioned, they're level, I think, now with, was it Derby's haul from last season?
Yeah. But they played good football, didn't they, at times? I mean, not consistently, but they weren't hoofing it down the pitch at all, despite the presence of the mighty Cousin.
Well, I think that's quite an astute signing from Phil Brown. I mean, Cousin, quite a wily individual, and I think bringing him in for what wasn't a huge amount of money.
No, 1.5. He's got very dangerous elbows, by the way. He's liable to get a red card somewhere along the way.
How much was Giovanni?
I believe it was.
Is he on a free or something ridiculous like that?
It was cheap anyway.
Was he not released from his contract by Man City? It was a mind-boggling fact.
I mean, I think Phil Brown said himself that he was stunned that he could even bring in someone of Giovanni's quality. So
right.
He had to bring in translators, but he's more than happy to be doing that.
Explain to Giovanni what kind of level of commitment is required at that level of club, which I think means basically you have to do a bit of work. But 4 goals in 6 Premier League starts, not bad going.
It's not, and it's just a pity that there's no Dean Windass. It'd be nice to see him there. But
Indeed so. Well, there you go. Well done, Hull. And how many of these slip-ups like this game and the Fulham game can Arsenal afford? Rafa, what do you think? Is this already a compromised season for them?
No, that's too early to say that. But I think
I'm in a hurry.
It depends on what's happening on behind them on fifth spot, because as I said at the beginning of the season, I think unfortunately for them, fourth spot is again the most likely outcome.
Right,
fourth or third at best. So as soon as there's some pressure from behind, then things get very complicated. Because I don't think they're playing for the title. I don't think Wenger thinks he really is playing for the title, despite all these positive noises that he's making.
I think the other thing they have to worry about, as you say, what's going on behind them, or indeed in front of them, the fact that Aston Villa are making a very good case so far, see how long that lasts, for taking one of the top four spots. Arsenal currently in fourth place, but you've got Man United, who presumably when they play their extra game will start to move back towards contention, given that that is at home to Fulham. Aston Villa, same 11 players again, another 2-1 win for them. John Carew, a great goal, 8 times in the Villa's last 11 games. Chelsea and Man United both won. Chelsea with a cracking goal from Bissingua, United with a brilliant assist from Rob Stiles. I wonder, do referees, are they having some kind of covert plan to get video technology introduced by keeping it at the top of the agenda with truly shocking decisions every week?
I don't think they're sort of consciously making an effort to do this. This is the same as every season. It's just poor decisions, and I guess we just have to get used to it.
Is there a groundswell of opinion now that it is going to make video technology inevitable?
It could be interesting, because there were a couple of big decisions actually at the weekend in the big rugby league games where video technology is implemented, and there was a couple of replay instances where the play was held up for around 5 minutes.
Really?
Especially in one case. So I mean, you transplant that back to football, and then it would knock back a lot of the pushes forward for video technology.
Yeah. I mean, generally speaking, those decisions could come through within the space of time it takes to get John Terry's arm off the referee, or you know, whatever the particular instance was. Now, Wigan Man City, that's where you were, Kevin, and you had a delightful time in the fair city of Wigan, didn't
you? Yes, I'm a Wigan admirer. I mean,
you're in love with the place.
I am. I mean, I wrote a column to this effect at the end of last season. Now I'm going to chunter on in the podcast. Wigan, a town of about 80,000 people. People say the crowds are small, and okay, maybe rugby league has a greater following, but 18,000 is not bad against that context. Their record signing is still Emil Heskey at $5.5 million. Only two teams in the Premier League have a record signing of less than that.
Should we try and guess them here?
Yes.
Which?
I think it's West Brom and Hull, actually.
But, is it?
Yeah,
oh, okay.
Yeah. But however, but getting back to Wigan, but the thing is, despite all that, they have a good squad, not just a good team, but a good squad. Young players, clever signings. People who have been very cheap or cost nothing. Amrazaki, top scorer in the Premier League at the moment, I think, today, with 6 goals in all competitions.
Well, it was a fantastic performance in many ways from Wigan. It helped by some interesting decisions by Steve Bennett, the referee. but was it undeserved, the victory?
No, it was deserved. But also, getting back to this is fascinating. At the time, watching it live, you see Palacios hurling himself through the air, and you think, that's just ridiculous. And then you look at it again and you think, well, there is contact and he hurls himself. I think it's actually both a penalty and a booking for simulation at the same time, which would have made footballing history, possibly.
Definitely, definitely. I mean, he showed fantastic effort and willpower to actually get to the ball and then just sort of undid it all.
Gets the ball first, does he?
He does get... Oh, yeah. He definitely gets the ball first. But, I mean, as you say, there's the argument you say that the over-theatrics of it should almost either warrants the booking or you take away the penalty as well.
Now, questions raised when Man City signed all their exotic cast of characters about how well they would cope with the more rough and tumble games, and I guess the obvious question would be, having lost at the Widdeen Stadium in the Carling Cup against third tier Brighton, and now lost at the JJB in consecutive matches, are they equipped for the rigors of a Premier League or football?
I must say, first of all, that Wigan didn't sort of kick them off the pitch in any shape or form. They pressed quite hard, but Wigan also played good football in the game. I felt that Man City were still very, very flat. You could have guessed immediately who'd been to Sao Paulo and back in the same week. Robinho had a hopeless afternoon.
What was he doing in Sao Paulo midweek?
Oh, he was sorting out getting rid of his agent, and his father's now his agent. His previous agent, by the way, allegedly got $4 million for doing the transfer deal, so his previous agent's probably retired, I would imagine. That's probably the main reason. I couldn't work out why you have to go back to Brazil to do that. I don't really follow it.
Yeah, very strange. James, I mentioned Pompey against Spurs.
You did.
And 2-0 to Pompey. Spurs... £100 million, is it, they spent? And they're bottom of the table? If Wenger's feeling sick, what must Wendy Ramos be feeling?
Straight off to the hospital sometime soon, I'd imagine. Yeah. Yes, it was another inept performance from his side. And as today is the one-year anniversary of his time in charge at Spurs, I think it's a fair sort of question to ask, what exactly has he been able to bring to the club when he first came to the job? Obviously, he brought the Carling Cup. But yes. I don't know if that's really enough for Tottenham fans right now. They're bottom of the table. Is it the worst league? Is it 53 years,
53
I think?
Years.
It's pitiful, really, that their performance yesterday was, as mentioned, very poor. Tactically naive, I think he was, and some of his personnel decisions were a little bit strange, to say the least.
Well, these are two of the charges that have been laid against him. One, the fact that he was facing a team who'd conceded 10 goals in the space of, what, 3 or 4 days. So it might have been a good idea to have a go at them instead of playing one man up front. And secondly, that he seems to have picked his team, I don't know if this is true, with one eye on the UEFA Cup midweek.
Well, it's interesting. He explained afterwards that he perceived that the Pavlyuchenko up front on his own role, because it apparently worked against Newcastle, that fantastic team right now.
That was against Newcastle.
Exactly. Would then work down at Portsmouth, and it just didn't work at all. Pavlyuchenko looked a little bit slow on his feet, and it sort of enabled Sol Campbell, who often struggles against, I think, quite pacey forwards, to really sort of... He had a very strong game, and he managed to take him out of the game. Come half-time, he opted for more of a 4-3-3, bringing on Lennon, playing him on the left, and Bentley in his more preferred position on the right. But Bentley's delivery is still very, very poor, and Lennon probably remains the most frustrating final product player in the Premier League today.
James, can I put just a different emphasis on this? I mean, you're probably right in many ways, but I still think that the manager in this complex modern structure we have now has been badly let down by Daniel Levy and Damien Comolli in terms of signings. All right, he could have started with two if he'd played Bent as well as Pavlyuchenko. I don't think that would have been all that brilliant. This isn't wisdom after the event. I remember writing in the paper, why not just take the money for Berbatov? You make a few million less, and at least get it early and have time to make signings.
Yes.
They should have signed someone like Jermaine Defoe. Wouldn't he do well in a...
Well, they should... Too expensive now. Right. If they'd done it early, maybe they could have got Arshavin. I think Pavlyuchenko would be a better player with Arshavin there. But Pavlyuchenko has never been a kind of outstanding superstar. Nobody would claim he was.
No. I mean, I think Kevin makes a very valid point. I mean, there is a cumulative blame, which is fair to be levied at Levy and Comolli, but it seems that Juan de Ramos has somewhat dodged bullets, I think, for the previous 364 days, and yesterday was probably about time that he took it in the neck from Spurs fans.
We should just add, by the way, that I think Spurs are in profit this summer. For all the spending, they've actually made a profit in the transfer market.
Segueing neatly along, there was the Merseyside derby, of course, on Saturday, with Everton losing once again. And Liverpool off to their best start ever under Rafa Benitez, the second best in Premier League history. Although I still think it doesn't quite feel like it. But David Moyes interestingly admitting that his contract situation is probably having a bit of an effect on the team.
Yeah.
Next up for Everton in the league is Newcastle. Here comes the cavalry. now, or at least they're not really under Joe Kinnear, are they? Because he forgot to tell Mike Ashley that he had a touchline ban still in place from his last post of employment, Nottingham Forest.
It was so long ago, it's a statute of limitations.
I have to say, I'm quite impressed with the FA that they automatically knew this.
They blew the dust off the paperwork and there it was.
They remembered that he called a match official Coco the Clown.
Coco the Clown. Yeah, he's got, there are some great quotes. He gives good quote. Our friend Paul Doyle coming up with a good one this morning. He had a bit of a rant. He's saying, I'm no mug, I'm no cockney either. He says, there's always someone wanting to stab you in the back, but I'll take it on the chin.
That's good.
It is good.
I just think that, he says, I'm no mug. Obviously he isn't, because he is picking up 100 grand a month and he might not even get one game.
Right.
You know, if the deal comes through, by the time the 20th of October comes round against City, he would have pocketed 100 grand and not even be sitting on the bench.
I was on a two-bit radio programme, some station called the BBC. And
I listened to you on that,
yeah,
Kevin.
Yeah, sad. But suddenly they said, Kinnear's the new manager, and they had him on the line about 2 minutes later, after we'd all said he wasn't a good appointment. But then, within seconds, he's saying, oh, you know, and Keegan's coming back, and so is Shearer. And I thought, I'm sure he hasn't been told to say this by Mike Ashley.
You wrote a good piece on this about the complete confusion. and veteran of one crazy gang, this is the perfect place for him. You say, where else would a temporary employee announce an imminent takeover and then declare that Kevin Keegan and Alan Shearer would take charge? It's mind-boggling.
It's just a bit depressing for me, because I'm also on a pay-as-you-go basis here in the pod.
Right.
I'm just thinking, you know, what is Sean, who is Sean negotiating with, and what's going to happen once this is being sold to Nigerian consortium?
There's no parallels whatsoever. I just get one other thing. Sorry, who were the other 16 choices? We know about, because he was the 17th choice, wasn't he? Yeah.
18th, I think.
18th. Okay, yeah. They went through 17 and got blown out by the ball. And so we know that Terry Venables was in there. And we know that Glenn
Hoddle. Alf
Ramsey,
I think.
Were you contacted, James?
No. No. If you're a manager and you weren't, you have to seriously look at your credentials
Gaza.
At this point. It's sorry, producer Pete. Coco the Clown. that's probably enough Premier League for now, hey? Next up, we've got Sid Lowe, fresh from his trip to Barcelona. Serie A, Jose Wales has in to lose the Milan derby. And the Bundesliga, Klinsmann's team beginning to resemble his playing legacy. Rafa, going down easily. Okay, next up in this week's Football Weekly, Sid Lowe, Dr. Sid there in Spain.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well, Sid. Are you just getting off a train?
About 20 minutes. I'm sitting in the station at Atocha at the moment, having just come back from Valencia last night.
All right. And what was going on in Valencia?
Well, Valencia were going back to the top of the table in the Spanish league. They beat Deportivo 4-2 with a really brilliant performance. I mean, the front four in particular was superb. David Villa was really very, very special indeed. And Valencia, I know we've talked about this a bit before, but I think Valencia, if they don't get key injuries, particularly to Villa, they do look very, very strong this year.
Wow, what a way they've turned it around from the disaster that they were last season. And now that's one example of a new owner coming in and really cleaning the place up instead of completely making a complete balls up of it as at one or two other clubs. Well done to Valencia then. Barcelona derby, that was a big game over the weekend, no?
Yeah, it was massive, absolutely massive. I was in Montjuic on Saturday night for that. It's almost impossible to know where to start because so much happened. And the fallout has been really, really intense because, of course, not only was it a game that Barcelona won in the last minute, in fact, not just in the last minute. I mean, it was so late Barcelona winning it that they scored the final goal on Sunday rather than on Saturday night when the game had started. So you not only have got that very, very poor refereeing performance, and then, of course, you've got all the trouble in the stands as well. And that's created a situation now in which the two clubs are accusing each other mutually. They're accusing the local Barcelona police of mishandling it. The Ministry of the Interior is having a go at Espanyol. And basically, everybody's pointing at everyone and blaming it on everyone else.
Blanqui Azul doesn't want to be left out of all the excitement, and he's posted in to point the finger at the Barcelona fans, who he says, he also mentions the shocking refereeing display and the fact that newspapers are claiming that the league has been bought by Barca. But anyway, he says that it was the Barcelona fans starting to throw flares into the tier below where the Espanyol fans were that kicked off all the trouble.
Yeah, absolutely. And in a way, you know, in a way, that's almost all the trouble there was. What basically happened was, with about 15 minutes to go, Barcelona's fans, who were up in the high top corner, as I was looking at the pitch to the right-hand side of Montjuic, of the Olympic Stadium, and they decided, they'd actually said in midweek on the website of the Bochos Nos, which is the Barcelona Ultras, they decided that they were going to give Espanyol a send-off from Montjuic, a send-off they really deserved. Because, of course, Espanyol at the back end of this year are going back to their own stadium, having been tenants at Montjuic for the best part of a decade. And that basically meant that with about 15 minutes to go, they started chucking flares down into the Espanyol fans below them. Now, what happened was, of course, that these flares then provoked a bit of a response from the Espanyol fans. But, you know, I'm loath to say much of a response, because in truth, Espanyol fans didn't do a huge amount wrong. They chanted at Barca's fans, called them names and stuff. One or two tried to get on the pitch and then sort of run across the pitch and get across to the bus. We really are talking about one or two. And the game was suspended for 8.5 minutes just to try and calm things down. And I do think, actually, that you know, the finger needs to be pointed at quite a few people on this. And I can see the arguments from quite a lot of the different sides. One of the things that was really striking about it was when this happened, when the Barcelona fans started chucking the flares down, and, you know, TV cameras showed kids crying and a couple of people were hurt, not very seriously, which is more down to luck than anything else. The fans turned on Joan Laporta, the Barcelona president, and started calling him names in the director's box. Obviously, the assumption being that, you know, it's your fault, Joan Laporta. You're the one we hate. You're the one that's provoked this. These are your fans. Laporta was absolutely furious. Laporta was turning round. Someone put a hand on his shoulder to tell him to calm down. He threw the hand off, basically told them where to stick it, told them, don't tell me to calm down, was shouting back at the Espanyol fans, saying, look, it's not my fault. I'm not the one who let them into the stadium. And oddly enough, Laporta has a point. He's the only president in the Spanish league that's really taken on the ultras. And these are Bochos Nos, who no longer go to the Camp Nou, most of them, who have been controlled by the Camp Nou. His argument was, it's Espanyol who let them in, it's Espanyol who are responsible for security, and it's Espanyol who should have stopped them. Of course, that doesn't prevent the bottom line, which is it's Barca fans who did it.
Sid, I wanted to ask you, I saw a bit of the game and it looked absolutely massive, and the sense of occasion was really palpable. But my question is, why is the stadium still half empty for a Barcelona derby? You'd at least expect a handful of Barcelona fans who are not ultras to turn up to that game.
Well, this is exactly the complaint that I've had, not just with Barcelona fans, but with quite a lot of fans of big Spanish clubs. And maybe you could go so far as to say fans in Spain in general, they don't travel to away games. And I do think it's sad that, as you say, a game like this, it's in the same city. It's not a long way from the Camp Nou to Montjuic. I think it must be about 4 kilometres at most. They should be able to send 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 fans up there. There's plenty of room for them. But the only fans that go are the ultras. And, of course, that means there's no kind of diluting factor. The only Barca fans there are basically nutters. And that's a real problem. It's also a shame, as you say, that the stadium's so empty. And this is why Espanyol are so desperate to get to their own stadium. Because while Montjuic is a gorgeous stadium for athletics, it's a terrible stadium for football. You know, it holds 55,000. Even yesterday, 30,000 is not a bad attendance. But it feels like they're rattling around a little bit. There's a running track which takes away the atmosphere. And it does ruin it to some extent. Although, as you said at the start, you're right. There really was a sense of occasion. But Espanyol fans cannot wait to leave Montjuic. It's a terrible place.
And that fan trouble, etc., wasn't the only controversy. There was also Henri's goal celebration. Dave asked, what the hell was Henri's goal celebration all about? Is he launching a new range of perfume? What exactly did you do? I didn't see this.
Right, well, I'll try and explain it to you in two phases, because I think there's two parts of this goal celebration that really matter. The first one, and the one that he's referring to, is that Henri ran to the corner flag kissing his wrist, just where you would normally spray perfume on if you were testing it, or maybe not testing it so much as stealing it from the duty-free section in the airport. and he went and started kissing his wrist. Now, my guess is, given the way Henri has talked about things over the last year or so, my guess, and it is only a guess, is that perhaps he's had his daughter's name tattooed on there, because he has talked consistently over the year or so about how much he's missing her after his divorce and so on. And he was saying in midweek that his life is in London because his daughter is in London. So my guess is that it would be that. Now, I think
Hang
actually...
Hang on a sec. So this is a player who's recently divorced, no longer with his wife, and has now started kissing his wrist. I wonder if... No, OK, let's...
Well, yeah, no, I'm glad you said that, James, because that was a joke that I thought was too crass and too low even for me to go to. He's now kissing the one person he really loves.
Let's get on to phase two.
Quotes, isn't it?
Anyway, yes, so that's the first half of the goal celebration. I think the second half of the goal celebration, and probably much more significant in truth, is that the game's just been restarted after 8.5 minutes after Barca fans have done this. Henry scores a goal, which is a bit of a scrappy goal, although he played well, and he decides now's a good time to go and run to the Barcelona fans and very pointedly do a kind of this one's for you sort of gesture. And Espanyol are furious about this. They're furious because they think he incited violence. They think he was saying, yeah, you're the boys, even though you're the boys that have just thrown flares. And Henry is one of five players that Espanyol have denounced to the Spanish Anti-Violence Committee for his acts. Now, Henry, after the game, I actually spoke to him after the game, and he was saying, well, I don't understand. I'm in the mix zone, and everyone is saying I'm trying to wind it up and cause trouble. And he said, look, I just think it's normal. We weren't aware of what was going on in the stand.
No, do the accents here.
No, sorry, it was awful, isn't it?
No, it's good. Keep going.
His argument was, look, when you score a goal, it's normal to run to your fans and celebrate, isn't it? Well, yes, but maybe not when they've been throwing flares. Now, obviously, in fairness to Henry, we don't know to what extent he was fully aware of what was going on. The one player I think that probably was even worse than Henry was Gerard Piqué, the former Manchester United player, who I think was aware and was very, very aggressively, very pointedly kind of dedicating the goal to the Barcelona fans. And I think that's something that, that is something that's gone down really, really badly.
Now, Sid, there's so much else we could talk about. I want to get your opinion on a couple of Champions League fixtures. Jala Blue posting in saying you didn't give Real Madrid enough credit for their 7-1 win against Sporting Gijón. But, Sid, I know your reaction is read the column because you did there. Sven's Cojones, who keeps posting in with the question of whether you're a Real Oviedo fan. Are you, Sid?
Yeah, this has been something that's been going on for ages. Yeah, I am. I thought everybody knew that.
All right, well, Sven wasn't clear about it, or his cojones weren't anyway. And they got demoted down because of financial reasons. Can you clarify what happened?
Yeah, essentially they didn't play some of their players, and their players denounced them to the Spanish Players Association. Right. And Oviedo, who were relegated on the pitch, were then given another administrative relegation in the same summer.
They went down to two.
Oh, two divisions at once in the same summer, yeah.
My word. Okay, now, on to the Champions League. We have Real Madrid on Tuesday taking on Zenit St. Petersburg. They're away. They haven't won away in the Champions League for seven games now. How do you think that one's going to go?
Well, I think when you look at the group, it's a difficult group for Madrid, which makes a change because they've generally had pretty easy groups. I do think this is tough, but I don't think Real Madrid would be particularly unhappy if they got a draw. The other thing is, and this sort of goes back to that point about maybe not giving Real Madrid credit. Real Madrid have an amazing ability to score goals. They have amazing ability to make things happen even when they're not playing that well. So I would expect them to score there, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if they do win that match.
Okay, Batty playing Juventus, who beat Zenit 1-0 in the opening game in that group. And now, meanwhile, Villarreal, who are they still flying high in the Liga? They're taking on Celtic, who desperately need, Kevin, I believe I'm right, after their opening draw, to get something there.
Well, I mean, I became almost catatonic in the summer while watching a pre-season friendly on TV involving Celtic. And it emerged afterwards that what Strachan had been doing was telling his players, never mind winning the game, I want to see how long you can keep possession for. And that's why it was so boring. This is because Celtic are really hopeless away from home in Europe. Their excellent record at Celtic Park is perfectly balanced by complete failure elsewhere. And I remember in 2004 in the UEFA Cup when Martin Neal was in charge, they knocked out Barcelona and then played Villarreal in the next round. And my wife and I went to the away game in Villarreal. The only good thing about it was we could stay in Valencia. That's the best part of it. As far as I remember, Celtic touched the ball at kick-off and didn't get it again in the remainder of the night. Villarreal just played them off the pitch. And Strachan's tried to address this and get away from a British style and maybe hold possession more and take the sting out of the game. But they're really up against it. I don't see how Celtic's defence can withstand the kind of skill and movement that Villarreal will have.
Seem fair to you, Sid?
Yeah, I think so. It's interesting. I was watching Celtic at the weekend against Aberdeen, and it's strange because Kevin said right. I mean, Strachan's been talking loads about making them defensively strong because he realises that away from home they're awful, trying to protect themselves and keep possession. Against Aberdeen, I thought their defence was absolutely appalling, and they do look like they're going to concede goals against Real. To answer your very first question, yes, they are flying high. They're joint top with Valencia at the moment. They're playing very, very well. They haven't been beaten at home now for 17 games. And I think for the first time this season, I look at them and I think they can actually afford to have one or two injuries and they've still got the squad to get away with it, when in previous seasons that hasn't been the case. I think they're very, very strong Villarreal, and I also think they're capable of being a bit more pragmatic than perhaps people realise. I think they can go quite a long way in the Champions League.
Interesting. On Wednesday, meanwhile, Atletico Madrid are at home to Marseille. Atletico looking brilliant in the first game, presumably. They're very much the favourites there at home. Okay, very, very good. Sid, that was fantastic roundup from Spain. We'll speak to you on Thursday.
on Thursday. Hope so.
Thanks
Cheers.
A lot, Sid. Take care.
Bye.
Raphael Honigstein up next. The big story, or at least the one I've heard about Raphael, is the fact that Bayern Munich have lost again, this time 1-0 away to Hannover.
Yeah. That is one of two big stories. Certainly Bayern's worst start in 31 years. Klinsmann, after six games, has amassed a total of 8 points, 2 wins, 2 draws, and 2 defeats, which is totally average to the point of banality, and that's where they're ninth in the league, exactly where they should be.
Ribery's been out. He's come back in, then.
Ribery's come back. He's not 100% yet. He played a half. Maybe they'll get more out of him for the Lyon game on Tuesday. It was going to be really, really difficult. But there's a general sort of flatness around the team. Luca Toni and Klose are not really looking very sharp. Schweinsteiger's been very good, couldn't play. And there's this big debate about Mark van Bommel, who is the captain, but at the same time not secure in his position. And Klinsmann has rotated him a little bit. And there's a sort of a sense of, Klinsmann doesn't really know his best team. But also, even those who are guaranteed a place and not in top form right now. So the combination of both makes for very boring and unsuccessful football. No, he's not diving, no.
No, that was my R knives being sharpened.
R knives being sharpened. I thought you were doing a dive again.
Seriously, that's your knives being sharpened.
Yeah, look. Yeah.
I wouldn't be mind by a knife that you sharp, the way you're sharpening
right.
knives. But knives are being sharpened. Of course, this is, you know, worst, as I said, worst start in 3 decades. And this is not the sort of form that Bayern can agree with themselves. And Uli Hoeneß, the general manager, is very important. I said, looking at the table really gets on my nerves right now. All these teams in front of us, what do they do there? You know, how dare they? And they have to turn it around very quickly. And I think the real fear is not so much the Bundesliga, because I think they will be okay. But, of course, they've got this devilishly difficult group with Lyon and Fiorentina, who I think are being underestimated. And I said that before the Champions League started. And, of course, they're playing Lyon at home on Tuesday. And if they lose there, all hell would really break loose, because Klinsmann has come to this job saying, never mind the Bundesliga, we'll be OK, but I really want to have some big impact in the Champions League. And if that falls now, we're in trouble. They're in trouble.
Indeed. What's your second story, Raphael?
Second story is Hoffenheim and Werder Bremen, who played at a 9-goal, I should say thriller, but it wasn't a thriller. It was just absolutely absurd football that you couldn't predict from 1 minute to the next. Bremen were 4-1 up, then had a player sent off. Hoffenheim come back and equalise. It's 4-4. Then with 9 minutes to go, 9-man Bremen go and snatch a winner to make it 5-4.
Is that
unbelievable game?
Is that now 10 goals they've scored in 2 matches, Werder Bremen?
Yeah, and
wow.
They've nearly conceded as many as well. They conceded 6, and that's been a theme of this Bundesliga. Even the top teams are conceding a lot of goals. It's become a very, very open league, very unpredictable. A little bit like the Premier League maybe 10 years ago, where you had a lot of 4-3s and these type of results. And all of a sudden you wonder, you know, is it because everyone's forgotten how to defend in this new brave world of attacking one-touch football? Or are the attacking departments and teams so good these days that they get all these goals? But while the league is figuring that out, it's just been absolutely fantastic and really, really entertaining. And Hoffenheim, of course, are really emblematic of that whole thing, because they come out of nowhere. They're a newly promoted team, and they're playing, along with Leverkusen, probably the best football in Germany right now. It's really absolutely breathtaking.
Brilliant. Take a breath for a second, because next up for Werder in the Champions League are Inter, away in Milan. And Inter just coming off a massive game in Serie A, the Milan derby. To tell us more about that, let's see if we can now join Susie Campanali on line one. Nothing on line one. Let's try line two.
Hello.
Ah, there you go. Hi, Susie. How are you?
I'm fine. How are my favourite boys?
If that's us... We're all well. So much to talk about, so little time as ever to do it, Susie. But we have to start with a Milan derby. The Rossoneri are back, and so is Ronaldinho.
Absolutely. He scored a towering header, which is frankly unusual for him. But he scored it on Kaká's cross, and Milan played the Brazilian trio up front of Caparo, which is Kaká, Pato and Ronaldinho, and it worked. It worked brilliantly, and Inter's unbeaten run is finished. The newspapers are all, Maureen, you're not so special now, are you? And a lot of people are now apologising to Ancelotti for calling for him to be fired a couple of weeks ago.
Right. Mourinho, of course, has been winding up everybody. He's had another pop at poor old Ranieri over the weekend. But just on the subject of Ronaldinho, I was really impressed with the way that Milan swept upfield and the way that he started the move. He fired the pass to Kaká, Ronaldinho, but then actually ran on and made sure that he was there ready for the header afterwards, which, you know, for a player who so many people have questioned his mobility and commitment, I thought was a big statement. Now, for Inter, all sorts of problems. They've got Werder Bremen coming up next in the Champions League. But meantime, they had Burdisso sent off. And then Marco Materazzi, who'd been subbed off, got a red card while he was sitting on the bench. Tell us more.
Yes, he couldn't quite keep his mouth shut despite being substituted. But that's Materazzi for you.
But they've got two centre-backs out. And I don't suppose Cordoba's fit yet, is he? So they've got some problems at the back, Inter, haven't they?
He's fairly fit. It was actually a pretty dumb decision to field Burdisso instead of Cordoba because Burdisso's quite slow and the Milan trio were rather quick, so they had all sorts of trouble. But to be honest, the whole Inter approach was bizarre. Last week, Mourinho was complaining that Lecce played 10 men behind the ball, and then he did exactly the same thing, which is odd, really. I mean, this is the first really big game they've had against a top team, and if they play like this, which is basically defend and counter-attack, that's not exactly the kind of championship-winning team you want to see.
Indeed so. Meantime, up at the top of the Italian table, big surprises. You've got Lazio, like the good old days. They're leading the way.
First time in 6 years at the top of the...
Is that right?
Yep.
Magnificent performance once again from Zarate, no?
Oh, absolutely. He's scored another brace. He's had the best start of a foreign player in Serie A since Shevchenko in his first season with Milan. He's doing remarkably well. I mean, everyone at Lazio is just astonished. They've scored 13 goals in 5 games, the team. So they are well worth that leadership. And Delio Rossi is not exactly being quiet about Scudetto chances.
And how about Napoli in second place? When was the last time that happened?
Far too long ago.
Indeed.
Much, much longer. And they're there with Udinese. Napoli are doing brilliantly well, actually. They are the only unbeaten side along with Juventus now, because Inter have lost their unbeaten record. But Catania have the same number of points as Inter.
Amazing. Of course, managed by Walter Zenger, former Inter legend, who, somebody was pointing out to me the other day, apart from his 10 years off around the world gaining managerial experience, he also had a spell doing telesales on Italian TV on a kind of fitness and vitamin patch thing, didn't he? Like one of those, you know, riscaldamento things that you kind of strap on if you've got a muscle pain.
Yeah. To be honest, a lot of players end up doing this sort of thing.
Indeed. Not all of them end up, though, near the top of the Italian table. 2 points we ought to very quickly pick up on. One is, why on earth nobody picked up Zarate in the Premier League? I don't know if anyone's got... Because I thought he was outstanding for Birmingham City. How he managed to then end up in Lazio? Can't have paid. They didn't pay much money for him. The irony being that his brother is one of the most legendary, along with probably dear old Luther Blissett, is probably one of the most legendary, and Ian Rush, of course, is one of the most legendary failed signings in Serie A history.
Yeah, well, you know, genetics clearly aren't everything.
There you go. Some hope for my brother then. Raphael will not be silenced because he and indeed Here We Go both want to ask the same question about Milan's goalie Cristiano Abbiati declaring his support for fascism in a magazine published by the Gazzetta dello Sport, basically saying that he agrees with a lot of the central tenets of fascism, like family values and Christianity and all that kind of thing. Susie.
Well, in this case, he joins Paolo Di Canio, really, because he has said very similar things. But Berlusconi, who is the president of Milan and also, unfortunately, the prime minister of Italy, is rather right-wing. So he's in the right place.
All very regrettable, though. And somebody else, we'll get onto that in a second, talking about Slaven Bilic in this context. But in the meantime, Susie, thank you very much for that. Sorry it was so brief and rushed. And we look forward to speaking to you in more depth further along.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Susie.
Bye.
Bye-bye to Susie Campanile. James Dark, quick word on the Championship. QPR, fans paying £50 a ticket to see them lose at home to Derby County.
Indeed. Well, the Derby fans who said that they weren't going to go, they did go. They did pay the money, and at least they got 3 points.
But they get cheaper tickets, don't they?
Their tickets were raised up, but yeah, not to the extent. But it wasn't a great result for QPR. Wolves still flying, still unbeaten, playing well, scoring a lot of goals still through Ebanks Blake, and looking pretty good.
That's a pacey roundup. Next, from the Championship to the Champions League. Many, many thanks to all the listeners who've been making contact with us here in our lonely geostationary orbit. We've now got almost 1,100 members on Facebook, which I'm told is a lot. Among them, Dax Williams, who posted in a very misguided comparison with Top Gear personnel. Danny Stacey from Taiwan. Villa Support Group here as well. Villa Support Group. For goodness sake, we're going to have to get a restraining order or something there. Posts. Post of the week, the great Barry Sanders, who offers us highlights of the Newcastle versus Tottenham Carling Cup game. Only they're not titter. And he posts a link here, which I can't read out. It doesn't make any sense. But go to YouTube and put in Japanese binocular soccer. Really, and have a tissue nearby. You might have one next to your computer anyway. No. Anyway, it is unbelievably funny. I have cried several times watching that. Now, Sarah the Bear, don't want to attack the podcast I enjoy so much. But what is it with the silence on the Croatia racist abuse and the dubious views that Bilic holds on this? He's upset, naturally, about the £15,000 fine the Croats have been hit with, which is ridiculous. You wait for say there's going to be zero tolerance for fascism or for racism.
No, there's lots of tolerance for fascism.
Right, okay. But for racism, and then they give him a tiny fine. So I don't think anyone can agree with
also
that.
Also, second offence. I mean, there was a racist at the Euro 2008 as well.
Yeah, I love this thing about that they were... Oh, well, anyway, we'll skip that bit. But on the subject of Slaven Bilic, now, we had a big thing during the Euro 2008 podcast about the fact that supposedly we'd gone soft on Bilic, etc., etc. And as far as I know, Bilic has never come out and said anything condoning fascism or expressing his own fascist views. So until that point...
I think it's his family background has been tarred for, hasn't it? His family are well known.
Well, his father was a nationalist dissident, etc., as Jonathan Wilson.
Well, his musical choices have been questioned because he has been playing this music from a sort of far right, ultra nationalist Croatian musician before the games.
Thompson. Yeah. The song that he uses apparently isn't. Yes. Yeah. Well, it refers to the machine gun, apparently. Yes, he has used this this music, which I don't know if all Thompson's music. I don't know. So my jury is still out. Mm. Slaven Bilic will be relieved to hear on the subject of Slaven Bilic. That's why I won't come down on him yet. But the second he steps over that line, Football Weekly is going to be the first to blow that whistle. Hardcore Prawn, is anyone else a bit perturbed at seeing the news that the Euros are going to be expanded to a 24-team competition in 2016? I am, because it means I'm going to be sharing a flat with Barry for two months long.
It's diabolical.
It is diabolical.
Appalling.
Although the Scots love it.
I must refute this appalling slander. I remember saying something to you, you've said to me, you should be pleased, Scotland might qualify.
That's
and I said,
cheeky.
Scotland pushed for it very hard.
I disown them entirely. But I blame Gordon Smith, the chief executive, who arranged my mortgage, my first time I moved house, by the way. Not a chief executive of the SFA, he was a financial advisor. Oh, anyway, okay. Getting back, in Scotland, we all know each other. Getting back to this, Ireland and Scotland proposed it. It's outrageous. When I was young, Scotland qualified for 5 World Cups, some of them with as few as 16 teams in them, by winning matches. And I'd like to go back to that. This new stupid thing, we're going to have 8 teams, is it knocked out after an enormously long, boring...
It's roughly 50% of all European nations, and I'm talking of everyone from kind of Estonia to Lithuania to Andorra to Liechtenstein, etc. 50% of them will be in the European
championships. But the groups will take place for however long it takes, week or whatever, to eliminate is it a quarter of the teams or something like that? It's ridiculous.
It's shocking. Horrible. And on the subject of UEFA's bold new plans... you want to talk about the Europa League. Men Call Me Phil posting in about this, and with a very ironic and dry email about this is exactly what the UEFA Cup didn't need. But James, they've addressed everything except the thing that was the problem in the first place.
Exciting UEFA brainstorm alert. Yeah, I'd like to have been in the meeting where this one all came about. But it's a new bumper 48-team group stage, I believe, as of next season. So the Europa League is now going to be in existence. And we did some shambolic research and discovered what Europa has previously been known or what it might have been named after.
There's a supermarket in London that's called Europa.
But is there?
Yeah, yeah. There used to be, anyway.
Apparently, it was also the sixth moon of Jupiter, apparently.
Right, less
still
famously.
Still is, though, isn't it?
But it may find another one since then.
Okay, probably the moon will be changing its name after this.
UEFA moon.
But the problem is that the rubbish teams from the Champions League are still going to be dropped in at a certain point. That's not changing.
I don't believe so, no. Although there is a thing in ref.
Although there's slightly fewer rubbish teams from the leagues because... they'll be getting rid of runners-up and cup competitions.
Oh, okay.
No longer allowed in.
Oh. The thing is, there's not a single fan anywhere wants to watch a UEFA Cup group or Europa League group. Mm. It's such contempt for supporters. They hope to sort of squeeze 10 pence more out of it in TV rights.
Totally. My own personal view is I'm one of the few people who think there still is a place for the UEFA Cup, yeah. a second tier European competition, mm-hmm. but just have it as a straight two-leg knockout for every team.
Only 50 countries can win the Champions League. What the other 50 countries are supposed to do? There should be a competition of more widespread nature.
Totally.
Fair points all. And perhaps in future, instead of attacking Arsene Wenger needlessly, Michel Platini should look at the damage his own organisation is doing. Yep, see, Football Weekly not afraid to speak out on the big issues. So, straight on to the Champions League, which we talked about one or two fixtures already. But let's just stop for a second and look at Aalborg taking on Man United. And that was straightforward, do you think, for United?
Aalborg, home at Celtic Park, very weak team. Yeah. They'll lose.
All right, then. Arsenal hosting FC Porto. Are Arsenal going to bounce back, fellows?
It'd be a tough game. Porto, I mean, still very strong in their own domestic league and won at the weekend, I believe. But it's a good opportunity for Arsenal to bounce back.
Cluj, meanwhile, are going to be hosting Chelsea.
Is it true they don't have a single Romanian player on the team? Is that correct, Cluj?
It's not in my notes.
So it can't be.
They're fifth in the table.
They have lots of South
in
Americans,
Romania.
That's for sure.
Yeah,
I read somewhere the starting lineup for that last game in the Champions League had no Romanians at all.
Okay, they are fifth in the table in Romania, 1-1 draw with Steaua Bucharest. And they did look, they really caught Roma on the hop. A couple of brilliant counter-attacking moves. Whether they'll be able to do that against Chelsea, I think we all rather doubt. But then, who would write them off after that extraordinary performance there? Liverpool are hosting PSV, who, of course, lost at home to Atletico Madrid last time out. And on that bombshell, listeners, I say thank you very much, everyone. We'll be back on Thursday to round up all of that and look forward to the weekend. It just doesn't stop, does it? It's relentless. Producer Pete, many, many thanks. And you, Kevin McCara.
Thank you.
Raphael Honigstein, thanks for making it in. And you, James Dart.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Oh, it was a pleasure. And listeners, thanks for being with us. We'll see you on Thursday.